Hi, everyone. My name is Georgia. I'm an alcoholic. That was such a beautiful reading of chapter 5. I saw even some men get choked up when you read it that way. I think sometimes we speed through chapter 5 so quickly, and I feel like you do. I feel so grateful. These decorations are exactly how I feel. I feel like my joy, the center of my joy is Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything that's good in my life today is a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a freaking miracle that we're here tonight sober. And I love that it got you. But I think it was Jack's fault because he opened us up and got us all mushy and crying. Really grateful to be here. Thank you, Harlan. Thank you, Zan. Thank you to this incredible lineup of speakers, many who I know and love. And not to say that I don't love the other ones. I've just not met a couple. Just to be clear there. I've been sober since February 1st, 1993. My home group is the Pacific Group, and I've had the same sponsor for the last 22 years, and that's Marilyn S. Yes, I hear somebody howling. I have friends in this room already. It's so strange. Alcoholics Anonymous is such a small world. I was so, so lonely when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and so the weekend's going. I'm having so much fun, a ridiculous amount of fun with these guys, just troublemakers, all of them. This whole section over here, beware. But I ran into somebody I met at the Northwest Girls Talk. She was our host, Dirty White Ho. That's the name of her car. Her name is Maureen. Megan, sorry. I remember the name of her car, all right? And then there's someone else here, Terry, who I met in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. I don't know where she is, but we wrapped up a meeting like this, and we were still had energy, but there's nothing else going on that night, and I found myself pulled to music in the next room, and there was this big rotary party, and they were drinking, and they had an 18-piece big band, just the greatest music, and people were dancing, and so, I'm like, get drawn into the music, and so I'm just kind of standing at the door, and there were a couple people by the door saying, come on in, can we get you a drink? I'm like, oh, no, I was in that room. I don't drink, and then I see Terry in there, and then both Terry and I just kept getting closer and closer to the dance floor, and we danced until the last song the band played. We had nothing to do with this party. We were like the favorites there. Everybody, we made friends. The band loved us. We were the last ones to leave. I don't get it when people say they don't have fun in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I have a ridiculous amount of fun, and it's in part because I'm surrounded by a lot of great people, and one of those is my friend Nancy, who is one of my favorite human beings on the planet. She's my gal pal, and she's traveling with me this weekend, and everybody needs a friend like Nancy. She is very loyal. I am always right. I'll come to her with a problem, and she's the friend who's always like, you're right, I can't believe they did that. Oh, wrong. But I call my sponsor. But she's the one who's always on my side, and not to say that my other friends aren't, but but she is fiercely loyal, and we have a lot of fun together. I don't remember when I had my first drink. Alcohol was always a part of my life. I remember the adults in my life drinking, and I was allowed to drink out of their drinks, so I feel like I kind of tapered on. There wasn't like that first drink. It was just like I kept drinking more and more, and my dad died of cancer when I was 6, and I was raised by a single mom. And my mom worked 3 jobs to support us. And so from the time my dad died forward, I have never been grounded. I've never had any rules. I ran wild. My mom worked, and when she was at home, she sat in front of the TV and didn't want to be bothered. She was tired. She was depressed. She never dated again. She never had really any friends. Her whole life's purpose was to take care of me, it seemed. And yet, there was a strange feeling in my house. If you've ever been around somebody where you just get that sense that they don't like you, that's the feeling I had in my house. And so I started hanging out with the older kids in the neighborhood at a really young age to try and feel connected. And I couldn't articulate it at the time. But I was lonely from the time I was just a little kid. I was an only child, and my dad had died, so obviously those played a part in that. But I was lonely in the only way I've ever heard it described here in Alcoholics Anonymous, like that bone-chilling loneliness. And I feel like I was born with these huge emotions. From the time I was a kid, my emotions were so big. It was like I was born singing the blues, you know. It was just like everything was so big. And so I started hanging out with these older kids, and they were drinking and they were smoking, and I just fell into line, and it was easy. And from the beginning, I was willing to pay the consequences for what alcohol did for me, and what that did is it filled up that lonely place inside of me where nothing else could, and I couldn't articulate that at the time, but that's what it did for me. I was arrested for drinking in public when I was 11, so by that time I was already drinking, a lot. I was a daily drinker by the time I was 12, which is shocking to me when I look back and I see my friends with kids that are that age, and I think I can't believe that that's how I was living. But at 10 years old, I started smoking, I started stealing my mom's car, and I started drinking with kids in the neighborhood, and the older kids were a lot more accepting, and I felt like I was a part of something, you know? And it seemed to settle those emotions down. And it didn't matter what I had to do to get it or what happened as a result of it. One of my biggest problems was how much I hated myself, which takes a lot of thought of self. I thought of myself quite a bit all the time and how much I hated myself. And so something else that started really early for me was suicide attempts. And I had my first suicide attempt at 12, another one at 13, and then another one before I got sober. But I hated myself, and I heard somebody say this at my Wednesday night meeting, and I got it right away, and he said, my first higher power was your approval. And I needed it like I needed air. I needed to know that you approved of me. And I wasn't able to put it into words, but I had this sense that if somebody loved me, then I would be okay. And so that's what I sought. I sought to be loved by teachers, by friends, by anyone, by my mom. My mom was at times charming and at other times terrifying. She was so rageful. And it was like you were saying, Jack, I didn't know what I was going to walk into. And I don't believe my mom was an alcoholic. I believe that she was affected by the disease of alcoholism. I know that now in recovery. I didn't know it at the time. But her mother was an alcoholic. My father was an alcoholic. Nearly everyone she loved was an alcoholic. I remember when I realized that one day, and I'm like, those people were all alcoholics that she loved, and I went, oh my God, and so was I. You know, I kind of was like, all those people made her that way. And so my relationship with my mom was difficult because I wanted her approval. But she was very, like I said, very angry. And when I would walk through the front door, I would say something like, hello. And that would just make her mad. And she would say, not now, Georgie. And she was so frustrated at just me saying hello. And so I would just go into my room. And after a while, she knew that I was drinking. She knew that I was smoking. And I remember she threw up her hands one day and she just said, if you're going to drink and smoke, I'd rather you do it here at home. And so that's what I did. I turned my room into this party room, and I had all my friends over. She called my room the opium den, although we never did opium, so that's not correct. But I would have friends over, and we would just pack into my room and do whatever. You know, my mom could not resist a deal with a purchase. So if you buy this, you get this free, or if you buy this, you get the second thing half off. And so my mom started buying stuff for us, you know, so she would come home with a couple cases of Meisterbrow, because if you buy one, you get the second case free, and it's a terrible beer, but it's beer. So I'm okay with that. And I remember one night she came home with a bottle of tequila, and if you bought the bottle of tequila, you got the matching shot glasses. And so she was really excited about that. And she said, so I got this bottle of tequila, it came with the shot glasses, and I thought when your friend Ellen came over on Thursday night to watch The Facts of Life, you guys could drink it. And there's so many things wrong with that sentence. Because there was still that sweet, innocent part of me that was watching The Facts of Life, you know, this wholesome little show. And but what I would do is my friend Ellen would come over, and then we'd have to drink to be able to go out, you know, because you can't just go out. You have to make sure that you've got some on board to go out. You know, you're not sure what you're going to get out there. So we would normally drink 7 and 7. That was our drink at that time. But this night, tequila was just fine in the little tiki shot glasses. And I always drank like a pig. There was never social drinking for me. I mean, I started at such a young age, and I always drank for the effect produced. My favorite show, it still is my favorite show, even though they don't make it anymore, is Sex and the City. And I watch it in reruns, and I love to see the girls go out, and they drink these beautiful drinks, you know, like Cosmopolitans or flavored martinis and beautiful glasses, and they're in beautiful dresses, and they're out at nightclubs, and they're drinking and laughing and talking about Mr. Big. And so I'll watch this, and I'll think, oh, gosh, that looks so lovely. I wish I could do that. I bet I could do that now. And then I'm quickly reminded that the way I drink is with a funnel and a hose. Like, this never happened for me. I really liked a beer bong. I like the prestige, you know, because no girl could beer bong as many beers as I could. It took a lot of projectile vomiting to get the number up, but I got up to 5 beers at once. And, I'm an old English 800 gal. I really like that. I like to get there. I like 10 high whiskey because it's cheap, and if you get that, then you get to get a pack of cigarettes, too. That's important. Later, I drank vodka because I was trying to keep my weight down. I remember one time going to Lake Havasu, and my boyfriend at the time had a boat, and so I had never been out there, and everybody ties off their boats, and it's this big party of people just barely dressed, drinking. I mean, it's just the best thing ever. And people are jumping from boat to boat, and there's all these skinny girls, and they have their little G-strings on, their perfect little bodies, you know, and I'm in my bathing suit, but I've got like a beer belly. I'm like, but but I can beer bong 5 beers. See what I'm saying? So that's what's important to me. So a pattern got set up for me very early on, too. I've had relationships since I was 10 years old. When I was 10, I had a 16-year-old boyfriend. Again, I just thought that if somebody loved me, then I would be okay. And so I was looking for love all the time. And Pat says she was friendly. I say it was a bit of a hoe. But, you know. Semantics. The thing about being in a new relationship that's so wonderful is you get these wonderful butterflies in your stomach, and everything suddenly seems better in your life. Every song on the radio, I love this song. The sky's blue, the flowers are gorgeous, life has never been better, really. And it's not about him, it's really just, I just feel good, I don't know why. It's about him. So, in a long-lasting relationship, when those butterflies start to die down, a long-lasting love replaces those. But for me, what would happen is when the butterflies started dying down, I would then punish you because you put the butterflies there and I'm not feeling them anymore, and it must be because you're not doing whatever you did to give me those butterflies. And if you loved me, you do those things. In fact, you do about 10,000 things you're not doing right now. If you really loved me, I cannot tell you how many times I've said that. If you really loved me. So what I would do is I would find someone else who would give me the butterflies and fill me up, and then I would cheat on you, and then you would dump me, and then I'd go to the next guy just so victimized by this horrible relationship when all I wanted was love. And I did that over and over and over again. So by the time I was 13, I was pregnant, and I ended up terminating that pregnancy at the urging of my mom and my boyfriend. And I didn't want to do that, but I remember going to yet the second doctor and them telling my mom she doesn't want to do this, and my mom just fell apart. And my mom was really tough, and I didn't see her do that very often, and I had never seen her that upset. And that's all it took, and I said, okay, I'll do it. And then what I did is then I punished myself for years, the way I drank, the way I did other things. You know, I just, I tried to drink that pain away. My friend Charlie C. says, as you're drinking, it's like you're driving this big station wagon through life. and all those regrets and remorse and all that crap, I'll deal with that later. You just throw it in the back seat. And then when you get sober, it's if you're driving that station wagon and you throw on the brakes, and now all that stuff's right here. And that's what the steps help us sort through. But I didn't have those back then, so I was just filling that station wagon with regret and remorse and shame and embarrassment and all those things that we do. I ended up, I don't even know how, making it through school, just barely going to summer school, going to continuation, because it was hard for me to go to school. I drank every day. That was my goal, was to alleviate the pain I was in every day. And that's all I cared about, and finding love. And those two things were very, very well matched. I ended up graduating, and as soon as my mom knew I was going to graduate, she claimed bankruptcy and moved home to her mother, my grandmother, who I believe was the meanest woman who ever lived. And my grandma lived in a beautiful town, but in this little shack of a house. She lived in Cambria, California. And it's beautiful, but as a kid, it's torture, because we were stuck in this little shack that she lived in. This house that was just falling down, and my mom and grandma would be in there reclining, their dueling reclining chairs, and they would watch brown TV all day. Now, every vacation, every long weekend, that's where we went. We went to my grandma's house. And they would watch TV, brown TV all day, like Bonanza and all these brown shows, and they would smoke all day, and, you know, the house would be filled with smoke. And I smoked, and I couldn't breathe, and I'd, like, open the door, and they'd say, "Shut the door! You're letting the smoke out!" You know, and they'd be in their house coats, and I would just be going crazy because I wanted to be home partying with my friends. I'd be trapped in this house, and we'd finally go out to dinner, and they would go to a bar, and they'd leave me locked in the car while they went in the bar for a couple of hours before dinner. Then we'd go to dinner. Then dinner would take like 2 or 3 hours, and we'd finally get home, and I'd be like, "Oh my God, another day is over. I'm going to be closer to being home again." And I'd be drifting off to sleep, and my grandma would come in for a chat. Now, my grandma said she was not an alcoholic. She would have this big tumbler that she would fill with vodka with like a splash of punch. And she would say, "You know, your grandma's not an alcoholic. I'm just a drunk." And now I know those words mean the same thing. But but she would lean over my bed and she would tell me how disappointed she was in me and how I'd ruined my mom's life. And that if my dad were alive, how disappointed he'd be in me. And she would tell me soon that she too was going to die. And that scared me, because I knew what my dad's death had done to my mom, and I couldn't even imagine it. I later found out that she started telling my mom that when my mom was 9, and my grandma had her when she was 18. And so my grandma died from the age of 27 until 90 when she actually died. I believe it's the longest death on record. And then before she would leave, after telling me all these things, she would say something like, "Sweet dreams. You know grandma loves you," and then she'd leave. And so when I graduated from high school and my mom moved up to live with my grandma, I was quite fine with that. Like, Crazy Town was all contained. It was 300 miles away, and now I could live the way I wanted to live. And so I'd been on my own since I was 17, and I don't know how I made it to 24 when I came to you. I don't know how, because I had to pay bills, I had to work, and somehow I would run my life into the ground, but I could always start over. I could always get a job. I could always pay my bills. But it was getting harder and harder to start over. And I identify as an alcoholic. I believe that I definitely suffer from alcoholism. I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. And I believe that my alcoholism will get me wherever I'm weak. So that may be food, sex, money, drugs, whatever. My alcoholism is always looking for a way out. And the way that that manifested for me is at 13, I started starving myself, and at 17, I started throwing up. So I'd be skinny and pretty, so then you'd love me, and everything would be okay. And I did not get any recovery from that until I addressed my alcoholism in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And same with, I mean, seriously, Harlan, you have fed us so much this weekend, I don't even know. I mean, I could probably not eat for another week and be just fine. But he was like, "Oh, hey, you want some bear claws?" And I'm like, "Ooh, bear claw, yeah, I want one, I want six, you know." And so I just say, "No, thank you." But But, you know, I said yes to everything. My friend Doug says, had I known I'd be speaking at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have said no to that joint. But I didn't. So I said yes, 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 you know, to everything. And so what happened for me is I somehow made it out of high school, made it into this great job. I was working for a nonprofit in Pasadena, pretty high-profile one, and I started having an affair with my boss because maybe he would be the one and he would love me, and he left his wife and his four children. And he was one of the first people to tell me that he thought I was an alcoholic. And I went to a couple of meetings with, he had two brothers in AA, and I was, you know, a good friend, so I was there, but I just knew it wasn't for me. And I ended up losing that job. Well, I couldn't stay there, so I went to another job. And then he and I were, you know, the butterflies weren't there. And if he loved me, they would be, but they weren't. And I got really depressed again. And so I decided that it was time. I needed to end my life. And my world has gotten really, really small by that time. And so I had a roommate at the time who was taking some pain medication. And so I took her pain medication, and I drank a bottle of vodka. And then I waited to die. And then I had this moment where I went, oh, my God, nobody's going to find me, because my world was small and she was out of town. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, nobody's going to find me. So I looked up the suicide prevention line, and I called it, true story, there was no answer. Story of my life, okay? So I looked some more, and I found a suicide prevention line, and I called that number, and I said, this is what I drank, this is what I took, if I make myself sick, will I be okay? And they said, no, you need to call 911. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I don't want to do that. So I said, all right, okay. So I call 911, I'm like, hey, I, you know, made a mistake here. This is what I took and this is what I drank. If I make myself sick, will I be okay? And they said, no, we need to send an ambulance. I'm like, okay, well, look, I'm sitting up right now. I'm talking. I'm fine, you know, so we don't need the sirens and all that. Just I'll be waiting. So the next thing I hear is, woo, woo, you know, and running down the hall of my apartment building. I'm like, no. And so they come to the door. I open the door and the paramedics come in, and they are so hot. So, you know, I'm like, hey, how you doing? They're like, we have to get you on the stretcher, ma'am. So they take me to the hospital, and I have my stomach pumped. And after they pump your stomach, they fill you filled with charcoal. And then you get have, like, the charcoal frown. But, you know, I'm still working it in the emergency room. And this is so crazy because I thought I was such a piece of crap that I wanted to take my life. And then on the other hand, maybe this is, I'm going to get lucky. You know, maybe this will be the person to love me. You know, it's a crazy place to be. So they're supposed to keep you on a 72-hour hold, but I talked the doctor out of it because we're really good at doing that. And so that's what I did. And I ended up leaving that night. And so the next day, I woke up and I realized that the paramedic station was just about a half block down. And so I took a shower and got all purdy. And went down, and I'm like, hi, remember me? You took me to the hospital last night when I tried to kill myself. How's it going? You know, so embarrassing. And they were very kind to me because they were used to dealing with crazy people. And they sent me away, and my roommate had come back from her trip, and she had this brother who... his wife was so mean that she kicked him out because he had this little problem with crack and crack cocaine. But he was better now. I mean, he hadn't been to a program or anything. Apparently, it was magic. He was just better. And she said, could he come stay with us? And I said, sure. Because he really, really liked me. And it absolutely didn't matter how I felt about him at all. Not at all. I needed somebody to love me so I'd be okay. And so he moved in, and it turned out he wasn't quite done with the crack pipe. And it's really hard for me to be with somebody who has a different buzz. I don't know about you, but I remember sitting with my friends, like as a teenager, and people getting high, and they're acting all stupid. I'm like, you're so stupid. Give me some of that. You know. And then now I'm stupid, so it's okay. And or going to a kegger party, and you see, like, three or four people drift up into the bathroom together, and you're like, well, what Like, four people just, what's going on? And then they come out of the bathroom and they're like, how's it going? And it's, I remember my boyfriend doing that and coming out going, babe, what? But then you get invited in and then you come out and you're like, hey, where's the keg? And it's not so creepy. So that's what happened with Danny. I said, you know, you're acting really weird, and I want some. And and he said, no, you don't. And I said, no, I do. And within 6 months, I lost everything. I got evicted from where I lived. I got fired from my job, and he sold my car for a piece of crack cocaine, which at the time went for $20. And wow, I just never, that was always one thing I was never going to do, you know. And I had no place to go. My mom and grandma were living in Crazy Town, and my best friend and I had grown up together, Diana, and we used to party together, and she grew out of it, moved to San Diego, was going to school, living a big life, and I had continued to live near and in our hometown, circling the drain. And when I had no place to go, her parents took me in. They had a room in their basement, and they were the family in the neighborhood who would invite me in for dinner. Like, I never ate dinner at a table with a family. I never ate dinner at a regular time. I cooked SpaghettiOs, hot dogs and hamburgers. I made banquet fried chicken, you know, anything that I could make on my own. That's what I ate, so I never sat down to eat dinner. And so, but Diana's parents would have me over for dinner, and I would listen to the way they talk at the table about their day and their goals, and it was weird, but I liked it, and I saw that on TV, too, what a normal family looks like, what normal, I learned everything from TV, really. I had a really, really weird impression of what the world was like, but so they took me in, and like I said, I'd been to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous before with friends who really needed it, and I knew that it wouldn't work for me. And so I tried, you know, just trying to control and enjoy it, and it was really painful. And I would try and go a day or two without drinking and try and keep track, and I like to document things, so, you know, marking a calendar and all that, and it just turned out to be a lot of paperwork, and and so one day I just thought, if I'm going to be miserable, I'd rather be drunk and miserable than sober and miserable. And I poured my first guilt-free drink, which was white Zin in the box. That's what was in the fridge. And I poured that glass, and I was drinking it, just thinking, this is it. You know, I had lost hope so, so long ago. And I knew that this was just how it was going to be. And there was a certain surrender there. And it was then that the phone rang. And it was a guy named Jeff M., and he'd been working with Diana in San Diego, and he had a cup on his desk with an 8 on it, and she had asked him what that meant, and he said, well, I've been sober for 8 years, and so she started confiding in him about her loser friend, me, and her concern about my drinking and my life and what had happened, and so she gave him my phone number, and one day I poured that glass of wine, and the phone rang, and it was Jeff, and he said, I understand you have a problem with alcohol. And I said, I do. And he said, I want to give you the number of a woman to call in AA. And he gave me Pat Wise's phone number, who you heard this morning. And so I called Pat, and she said, my husband and I are going to a meeting tonight. Why don't you come with us? And really, I could have thought of a million reasons why not before, but that day I couldn't think of one, and I said, okay. And it still gives me goosebumps that a stranger called me, gave me the number of another stranger who took me to a room full of strangers, and I've been sober ever since. When I try to picture what God's grace is, that's the picture that comes to mind, you know, and I do not take my sobriety lightly at all. It's the most important thing in my life. I plan my life around my sobriety, not the other way around. I was off to meet Pat and Vince Yeo, that, you know, I knew they were going to be just this really fantastic Oriental couple, and I drove over to their house, and they took me to the big meeting, the big Wednesday night meeting, and it was like this, you know, people were laughing, the light was on in people's eyes, people were happy and sober at the same time, which I, you know, didn't understand, And I felt hope for the first time in a long time. Pat said she'd be my sponsor until I found one, and started me on a very, very simple program. I'm so grateful that she did it this way, which was to go to regular meetings on regular days. And I did that. Now get commitments at each of those meetings. It was very simple. You know, I was about 2 weeks sober, and I had been following this direction for a couple of weeks and not really knowing what I was doing. I mean, I was terrified. I remember calling a friend, because I'd gotten directions to the women's stag, and I remember calling this friend who wasn't in AA but had known me most of my life, and I said, I don't think I can go because I don't know where to park. And he said, well, I have a feeling that when you get there, you know, it'll be evident where, like, the, I mean, this is such a stupid thing, but I mean, really, I wasn't going to go to the meeting because I was afraid that when I got there, I wouldn't know how or where to park. But I went terrified, and, you know, everybody was so welcoming, and everyone wanted me to join the softball team. Now, let me just tell you, I'm afraid of fastballs coming at my face, you know, so I'm like, no, but they also play volleyball at the yard, so I ended up playing volleyball, but not softball. That was a bad idea, but I did try. I did not have to tell them I didn't want to. They suggested that maybe I just play volleyball, but everybody was very friendly and welcoming. But so 2 weeks sober, that same family friend who told me that I didn't have to worry about the parking situation confided in me that my mom had been keeping secrets from me. And I had always been suspicious of that because my mom and grandma were really angry and really depressed, but fiercely dependent on one another. And they had this need to be together, but when they would talk, they would wound each other, and they'd sit together in silent scorn, but they would be together. And I didn't know what that bond was, but there's something. And they had this secret language that they talked in. It was kind of like a pig Latin, except it ended with Z's, like Zabba Zabba, or I can do more Fat Albert, but it was like this. It was like Abba Domba Womba Tuba Goba Tuba Scuba, except it was with Z's in there. And they would talk in this language, and I didn't know what it was. So anyway, so his family friend comes forward and says, you know, I know some things that your mom hasn't told you, and I think you should know. And so he told me these things, and I was like, what? You know, I'm so indignant and so entitled. And so I wrote down everything he said, because when you hurt me, I like to have every detail of how you hurt me, so when I throw it in your face, I don't miss a thing. So I write down every detail. But instead of calling my mom, which was my instinct, I called Pat. And I said, look at what I found out. And she said, it's so good that you have that all written down, because you're going to need that later. I had no idea what she meant. And she said, the thing that changed my life, she said, I want you to work on being a good daughter and granddaughter. And I thought she was crazy. I'm like, what? Did you not hear me? But I don't know how to be a good daughter and granddaughter. And so we came up with a formula, because I'm very literal. And so I would call once a week, I'd write once a week, and I'd visit as often as I could. And if I did those things, I would know at the end of the day when my head hit the pillow that I'd been a good daughter and granddaughter, and maybe, just maybe, I could stay sober. It wasn't about pleasing them or doing anything about them. It was about my sobriety. And so I started doing it. I had made a decision by that point that I kept hearing about getting your first-year foundation, how important that first-year foundation is, that that's what you build the rest of your sobriety upon. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to do everything I'm asked to do, and then when it doesn't work, I can go back to my glamorous life. Thank God it's worked. But so I said, okay, I'll do it. And so I started sending a card once a week, and I got a card that already said something I'd write, Love, Georgia. And then I started making the call once a week. Whew, brutal. And so I would have a topic. But at first when I would call, the only time I ever called is when I was in trouble. Like, I have no place to live. I don't have any money. I don't know what I'm going to do. Talk to you soon. And then I wouldn't call for months. You know, so every time I called, it was like, oh my God, we thought you were dead. So the calls were a little awkward at first because they thought I was dying every week. So I'm like, no, I'm just calling to check in, and I'd have a topic. And so I just started doing this and getting busy in AA. And You know, I started picking up the pace in those cards. I started hearing about how you guys were making amends to your family and started writing about my adventures in sobriety. And then I began getting a bit grandiose and imagining how they must be savoring each word in each card, perhaps in a beautiful decorative box or or maybe with a beautiful ribbon. And maybe on a cold winter's night, they would reread them and say, oh, remember this one? Oh, that Georgie. And a while down the road, I called my mom, and that's not what was happening. I said, hey, I'm calling to check in. And she said, well, we got your card, but Grandma's been having to white them out to reuse them, and we wondered if you could start writing them in pencil. And I wrote those cards in pencil. And the reason I did is because I had a sponsor who told me I'd never have to go through anything alone and that I could take all my problems to. And I was starting to have an experience of a higher power as the result of going through the steps. And I had this amazing fellowship, and I had friends I never dreamed I would have. And all of a sudden, I had tools that I didn't even know existed. Like, I was packing a hefty tool belt. And it's not fair, but he with the most tools has the most responsibility. And in this case, it was me. And so I wrote those damned cards in pencil. And I wrote a little bit less to punish them, but they didn't notice. I hate it when that happens, but so I continued to do that. Now, Pat had said she'd be my sponsor until I found one. So I found one. I didn't actually know I could keep her. But she had 17 years at that time, which I just knew. Like, she doesn't even remember what it's like to drink. She's all better now, you know. And so I ended up going with Tracy Jay at the time, and she had 7 years. And I just did whatever she was doing, and she went to all the meetings and to the yard and to just everything that we do in the Pacific Group. We have all these things that we do outside of meetings. And so I did that, and I started going through the steps with her. And I've actually, I had three sponsors my first year. And right now, my first 2 years, I had three sponsors. I've had Marilyn now for 22 years, and I have figured out there are two questions that if I can answer yes to, I know I'm with the right person and I can work anything out. And those two questions are, do I want what they have, and do I trust their judgment? And so there's been a couple of times where I have thought, maybe I need to make a move here. Actually, two times with Marilyn that I thought that, but I could always answer yes to those two questions. I wish I had those two questions earlier on, but I didn't. So I made it to that first year, which was a freaking miracle. And I had been told that in my first year that I was to take all the time and energy I'd want to put into a relationship, put that into AA, all the time and energy I'd want to put into going into school, put that into getting my steps done, get a little job to go to in between meetings, don't quit smoking, no major changes, you know, no relationship, which this was all just really shocking. But I thought, I'm going to do this, and then when it doesn't work, you know, I win. So I made it to I made it to my watch, and I had been able to stay out of a relationship, and I did for my first year and about an hour and a half. It was about 1:30 a.m. that I consummated a relationship with my new fella, and we got engaged 10 days later, and we got married 6 months later. And we were married my first 5 years of sobriety, and he is a fine man. We are both still in the same home group. We're both still sober, and the reason why is because we always put AA first. We always stayed close to our sponsors. When we split up, you know, we had a lot of meetings in common, and, you know, and it's uncomfortable. You know, it hurts. And you have to see each other at the meetings. It's just so terrible. And I knew my sponsor would understand why. I say, I think I should change some of my meetings just now while I'm going through this painful time. And luckily, I've been given direction that I walk through things with grace and dignity today, not tomorrow. And I was taught to show up at my regular meetings on my regular days. I was neither to seek him out or to avoid him. And if I were to run into him, not to ask questions, but to say something like, it's good to see you. Have a great meeting. And because I got sober at 24 and I've been in the same home group for the last 24 years, I've said, it's good to see you, have a great meeting, a few times. Mark and I split up, and I got involved with someone else right away. Bet you didn't see that coming. But I was still doing that. I was still looking for something on the outside to fill that emptiness. Now, I had begun to learn in Alcoholics Anonymous that the only way to fill that emptiness is by giving. It's not by getting. Getting is good. It feels good. But it has never filled that emptiness. Only giving. It's being of service. It's when I'm lonely, I have to pick up the phone. I have to reach out. I have to take the action. That's what fills me up. That's what builds my self-esteem. It's not letting you love me till I can love myself. It's loving you until I can love myself. And so we split up. I got involved with this other guy, and then I had to have, I had had a minor back surgery in sobriety, and I had to have a major back surgery. I had to have a spinal fusion, and they were going to go through the front, which was supposed to reduce the recovery time. My eyesight's so bad. Because I'm so old now. Really, I can't even read this. Okay, now I can. Okay. So I have the surgery, and the recovery time was supposed to be about 6 months, but I was one of those people where in the 1% where something goes wrong, and I ended up being bedridden for about a year. I was diagnosed with something called reflex sympathetic dystrophy, which can happen as a result of any kind of trauma or injury, and they thought that the trauma had been the surgery. And what happened for me is a couple days after surgery, my legs swelled up, it turned bright red, I couldn't even have a sheet touch it. It hurt so bad, and so they thought I had a blood clot, so they rushed me to the hospital, and they do all these tests, and they find out that that's not what it is. My doctor, who I was seeing, had a patient before me that he was unable to diagnose for about a year, and he had the same thing, so he knew exactly what I had, and the key to getting to this right away is finding it right away, and so if you don't, what happens is it can result in amputations or paralysis or horrible things like that. So I start seeing this specialist for this thing while I'm recovering from this back surgery, which was, you know, already really difficult. So I'm going to the hospital 3 times a week, and they're doing cervical and lumbar punctures, like big needles, and doing nerve blocks, and they're freezing nerves, and it's 3 times a week I'm doing this while I'm trying to recover from back surgery. And my mom and grandma couldn't be there for me. They both had vehicles. They weren't working. I can't explain, but I will tell you this. I was taken care of. I was taken care of by my friends in AA, and that's always been the way. You know, sometimes when you go through things, you think certain people should be here. I can't believe she's not here. Well, maybe they can't be, but God always puts somebody there who can, and I had babysitters every night, and I had people coming to take care of me that I honestly wouldn't have had a cup of coffee with, and I got to get to know people that I would have never got to know, and now I look back at what Keith Carpenter used to call the seemingly bad times of my life, and they're some of the greatest times of my life, where I've laughed the hardest, where I've felt the most connected. And at that point in my sobriety, I worked a really busy program. I was like, from 7 a.m. to midnight every night. I was going to meetings, working, you know, taking classes, taking people to meetings. I mean, it was just 7 days a week, nonstop, action, action, action. My program was action. And now all of a sudden it was like, And so I had to learn a whole new way to work a program. And I had found, peace and serenity in helping other people, and now I'm, you know, just this hunk of need. But what I came to find out is that by letting people help me, that was a way I could be of service and let them experience what I was able to experience when I've been there for other people who'd gone through surgeries and stuff. But I was really filled with self-pity, and this boyfriend who I thought was going to be the one came to me one day, and this was it was a really difficult time, and I don't blame him now. At the time I did, but he said he'd consider a relationship and a commitment with me when I was well, and he dumped me, and I was so heartbroken, and I called Marilyn, who I'd been calling, you know, like having the surgery, complications, can't work, lost my car, can't color my hair. I'm a little vain, so that was a big one. But, you know, like just losing all this stuff. And so now I call her and I'm like, and now I got dumped. And at the time she was learning to play guitar, so oftentimes I'd hear her plucking away in the background. And so I tell her this story and she says, oh, this sounds like a wonderful country western song. And she started playing a country chord progression and sang My Blues, and it made me laugh. And that's like been one of the greatest things of my sobriety, is finding humor in everything. And I'm really grateful that I have a sponsor who finds some of my most difficult times so entertaining. Seriously, though, I am. So at that time, I'm full of uselessness and self-pity, and, you know, I can pray for a character defect to be removed, but what normally happens is an assignment appears. Like in the case with my mom and grandma, I have that sense of entitlement, but the solution to that is to be of love and service. It's the opposite. And so there was a man in the group named Mike Finch, who you heard Joe talk about earlier, and I had gone from watching him walking and talking to being paralyzed from the neck down. He was diagnosed with ALS. And the thing that I never saw change about him, though, was his joy and his love of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I watched him for a while, you know, because I was intrigued and scared. Because what a scary thing to go through, right? And he just laughed, and he would get in the car or get in the van, and he'd bring these guys he sponsored from Las Vegas to Wednesday night, and then he moved to San Diego, and they were coming up to the big Wednesday night meeting, and I was there. Somebody would bring a lounge chair, and I'd be laying in the back of the room, or people were bringing me meetings at that time, but I would see him there, and his wife had also left him when he was sick, and so he and I became friends, and then we became more than friends, and I was able to spend the last 6 months of his life with him. And I wouldn't have chosen to love somebody that I knew was going to die, but we never know, you know? And it was so much fun. I mean, we had so much fun. I think about those days, you know, Mike and I, well, I'll just tell you this. So I'll get back on track. But after Mike died, his parents were so kind to me, and I always felt unworthy of their kindness. They looked after me. They checked in on me. On his tombstone, they have something for me. They have, you know, a son, brother, companion. And that was there in honor of us. And I'm like, I felt unworthy of their love. And then, I'm serious, maybe it was 5 years ago or something. It was the anniversary of Mike's death. I posted some pictures. And Mike's mom posted this story that I never knew. And that was when Mike was diagnosed. He had a family meeting. And the way you die of ALS is your muscles stop working and you suffocate. And so what they'll do is you can go into a drug-induced coma. And so that's what Mike said. He said, I don't want any extraordinary measures. I don't want a feeding tube. You know, when it gets to be that time, that's what I want. Well, what happened was Mike and I hooked up at the Mountain High Conference in Arrowhead. And then he had another family meeting and he said, I want the feeding tube. And so they felt like that was why he had those extra 6 months. And anyways, I used to call him the Make-A-Wish boy, which is really, really distasteful, but he had a good sense of humor. And it was true because he knew his days were numbered, and so he made the most of them. And he was so much fun. And like we do in AA, when we're in a situation that's uncomfortable, you know, I create commitments. And so I'd read Elizabeth Kubler-Ross because I wouldn't say obsessed with dying, but I was confused by it because my dad had died when I was young and I'd had friends who had died. And I had read some of her stuff and she had talked about photojournaling. And so I asked Mike if I could do that. And I became like the photographer and I took pictures of the last 6 months of his life, the good, the bad, the ugly, everything, trips back and forth to the hospital, having his feeding tubes changed, you know, people coming to say goodbye, his dad kneeling at his bedside. But my very favorite picture is Mike on the commode because he needed help to do that. And his two of his sponsees, one is sitting across from him just going, yeah, I got a problem. And Mike is on, you know, on the throne. And then another one just totally oblivious, sitting on the sink playing his guitar. And that's what our house was like. I ended up moving to San Diego and living in this house with all these people, and we were all taking care of Mike. And they were taking care of me, you know. And in falling in love with Mike, I found something redeemable in me that I didn't know was there, you know. And that's when, you know, I met Joe and fell in love with Joe. He's not right. He's just not right. So we hit it off right away. you know, you form a bond with people when you go through something like that. And we had such a good time, and it was a terrifying time, and it was fun. It was silly. It was sad. It was all of those things, and I got to feel all of it. And, you know, I think about how many moments I missed when I was checked out, just loaded. And I don't want to miss any more moments, even those. You know, I feel like I'm such a coward when it comes to feelings, but today I don't have to be scared because I've never had to go through anything alone unless I've chosen to in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I get to go do these things, and I get to be a part of these life experiences that I would have run from before. And what a blessing that is, and what a blessing it was to be there when he died. And that doesn't always happen, but his dad was holding one hand and I was holding the other, and it was just by chance that happened, or maybe not, I don't know. But about a month before Mike passed away, my grandma had died. By the time my grandma died, I'd been a good granddaughter, and my grandma had changed. Just as I saw my disease ripple into their lives, I saw my recovery ripple into their lives. And my grandma turned into this really nice grandma. She used to send me, you know, cards and tell me how much she loved me. Most of the cards, though, were with my notes erased. Not kidding. I found one recently. My notes erased, and then her scratch on top of it. I remember, just to get back to that, so I accidentally sent a card through in pen once during this whole pencil experience, and I called my mom and grandma. My mom goes, "Well, we got your card, but it was in pen." And I did not feel as spiritual that day as I did the first time they brought this up, but I knew well enough to say, "Oh, look at the time, I've got to run." And I got off the phone and I called Marilyn. I said, "That's it. I call, I write, I visit, I'm done." And she said, "Oh, I think you've made a wonderful amends to your mother and grandmother, and you don't owe them anything else." And I said, "Yes." And she said, "However, I think it would be a wonderful spiritual exercise if you continue to do so." And that's how she gives me direction today. It's like I've got option A or option B, and she'll say, "Well, you could do option A, or you could fight for the good. It's up to you." So my grandma had died, and I was able to be there for my mom emotionally, which I hadn't, obviously, when my dad died. And then Mike passed away, and I was living in San Diego, and I moved back to L.A., and my mom said that she needed to see me. And so I made that drive up to where my mom lived, and I had, by that time, my health was getting better. I still have chronic pain today. I treat it with Alcoholics Anonymous and Pilates, and I'm sure many people have suggestions, but we don't need to go there tonight. It works today. But I still have chronic pain, and let me just say this about that we're not supposed to say our case is different, but I will say that if you suffer with chronic pain, your case is different, but it's not in the way that maybe you think. It's that, for me, it means I have to do twice as much to feel half as good. And it's true. So I go up to see my mom, and she sits down with me and she says, "You know, I was waiting for your grandma to be gone because I need to tell you some things." And I had never felt it necessary to take those notes I'd written in that book and shared with Pat, and I never felt it necessary to throw them in her face. But she told me what those things were, and that was that my mom and dad had never been married, that my dad was an alcoholic and had, I guess the word was, a womanizer. I don't know the details about that, but when he was with his first wife, which now I know is his only wife, he had had an affair with a neighbor, and they had had a child, so I had a sibling out there. And the other secrets that I had written in that little book were that my mom took the money that my dad left me when he died and embezzled it from me, but that's not what happened. She used that to take care of me. She didn't get any money because his wife got the money. But so those are the secrets that I knew. Then my mom told me the whole story, which I'm so glad I didn't know any sooner, because I would have made it all about me. And that was that when my grandma was 8, her family couldn't take care of her and her sister, so they sent my grandma to live with another family. And in that house, she was like the house girl. She cooked and cleaned and was physically and sexually abused by the men in that family and never went to another day of school. And the way she got out of that was she married a man. She got pregnant with my mom. And then my mom got pregnant with this man, married him. And, my grandma got pregnant with my mom at 18 and moved out of that house and had my mom and then just started leaving her in boarding schools, divorced that man, and went on to a career, which my mom understood as a child was that she would go off into the desert and she was a special kind of nurse. And so she would come back from time to time. She'd forget my mom in these boarding schools for summers, and my mom was a lonely kid and ended up, after years of that, going to live with her dad and her stepmom. And my grandma came to visit one day in her shiny car with her furs and shiny jewelry and gave my mom the option, you come with me today or you never see me again. And so my mom went with the shiny objects. I would too. And so she went off in that car with my grandma, and the career that my grandma had turned to was racketeering and prostitution. And she was a madam out in Mojave Desert, and she turned my mom out to work the family business. And so my mom never went to another day of school after she was 15, and my mom was pregnant at 15 and at 16 and had children that she put up for adoption, and that was so painful that after that she just started terminating those pregnancies and had guilt and remorse. And she was physically abused and sexually abused by the men coming in and out to see my grandma and by men that were my grandma's husbands, boyfriends, whomever. And her story was the worst story I've ever heard inside of or outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was my mom telling me the story. And I had always seen my mom and what she was to me and what she wasn't giving me. You know, like, I needed love and guidance. If she had given me that, I could have been such a better person. I could have really made something with my life. I wish she would have got me in dance classes and music classes and told me about going to college and all of this. These were things she didn't possess. I thought she possessed these things and found me unworthy of them and withheld them from me. But she never possessed them. And I was so grateful that Pat gave me that direction to treat my mom and grandma like they were heroes and to be a good daughter and granddaughter and take care of my side of the street, because my mom was a freaking hero. The life she gave me was a life of a princess compared to the life that she and my grandma had and the life that I probably would have had too. I was so grateful. I began having a mad crush on my mom. Like, just crazy mad, because I'd already learned to take my mommy stuff to my sponsor and to my girlfriends, and so I got to get to know Betty, and she was so smart and funny and really damaged, and where I turned to alcohol, my mom turned to hoarding, and when I would go to visit her, I'd have to walk sideways through her house. Even before that time when I would go visit her, I couldn't stay in her house, and I was a paycheck-to-paycheck girl. I'd have to save my pennies so I could get a motel room so I could stay near her house so I could visit her. She didn't visit me. She didn't call me. This was all just me taking care of my side of the street, which was one of the most valuable lessons I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am only responsible for my side of the street. What you do on yours, none of my business. In fact, the dirtier yours is, the cleaner mine needs to be. And the only power I have any access to is on my side of the street. And this was such a powerful example of that, because I got to have this amazing relationship with both my mom and grandma as a result of me changing my behavior on my side of the street. And it was several years later that my mom was diagnosed with cancer. She had had some heart trouble and went through surgery, and they found the cancer then and was treated, but it came back, and she had lung cancer, and it turned to bone cancer, and then it turned to brain cancer, and I was able to be there with her for the last 3 months of her life, and I got to use some of the stuff I learned being with Mike, and I got to be there for my mom, and I wouldn't have been able to be had I not been consistent with those calls and the cards, and so much of the momentum that was built in that consistency was what made that space available for my mom and for me and my mom to have that intimate time together. I always tell the story because I can't think of one that describes her better, but she's 75 years old. She's so sick and she's dying, and we go to the hospital and she has to have yet some other test, and the x-ray technician comes out and my mom looks right at him and she says, "This won't affect my ability to bear children, will it?" She was so funny. And I would have missed it had I followed the well-meaning suggestions of my friends and therapists that, of course, I lied to. But, you know, all talking about setting boundaries and confronting and not keeping secrets and all of these kind of, you know, aggressive sort of things, where in Alcoholics Anonymous I was taught about love and tolerance. And as a result, I got to have this incredible experience. During that time, I got married and divorced another time. Not the man's fault. He's a fine man. I saw red flags. I painted them green and kept on going. We were not well suited for each other, but I was going to make it work. Damn it. And it was while I was with him that my mom died, and I didn't think I'd be able to survive, and my world started getting really small again. I was in an unhappy marriage, and I was really sad about losing my mom, and I was experiencing a lot of physical pain, and so I started changing my meetings and going to less and staying home because I was in pain, and Marilyn would say, well, when you stay home, are you in pain when you're at home? And I would say, mm-hmm. And she'd say, well, then why don't you come to the meeting and be in pain and take care of your spiritual condition? I'd be like, you don't understand. And what happened is I ended up being completely suicidal with double-digit sobriety. I was still taking speaking dates. I was still doing what we do. I had regular meetings that I was going to, but nothing like I had when I was new. And I would show up for speaking dates. I would cry in the car, wipe my face, go in, share but my experience, strength, and hope. And then I'd get back in the car and cry all the way home. And I told Marilyn that I felt like a fraud. And she said, you're not. You're walking through this. You're showing up for your commitments, and you feel terrible, and you're doing it anyway. That's the example. And I remember exactly where I was standing when I realized I couldn't drink. And I couldn't kill myself, because I think if you kill yourself, you have to come back and repeat all these lessons. I'm like halfway done. There's no way I'm doing this again. So I thought, how do I best pass the rest of this wretched time on earth? And the thought was, maybe I could be of service to someone else. And I started volunteering at the Midnight Mission. At that time, I wasn't working, and I did not know if I wanted to be a grocery checker or a brain surgeon. I had no passion for anything. And Marilyn said simply to say yes. And so I started volunteering at the Midnight Mission. I went through the steps again. I beefed up my program, and I tapped back into all of that stuff that I was taught. If I go to meetings, work with a sponsor, do the steps, pray, use all the tools I've been given here, everything else seems to fall into place. Friendship problems seem to resolve, work problems seem to resolve, financial problems seem to resolve, health problems, maybe not so much, but I'm in a better condition to deal with them. And if I do these things, I can tap into that joy at any time, and that's what happened. But it was harder to get out of the hole that I was in, and so it took a long time to do that. And as a result of that, I came out of that at last complete. And I had always been looking for somebody to complete me. Such a romantic notion. You complete me. Oh. But what that means is without you, I'm incomplete. And now you're responsible for my happiness. And you're never going to be able to keep me happy. I'm going to overlap you. That's what's going to happen. And so what happened was I was finally complete. And I had been through that divorce and was doing just amazing, happier than I'd ever been. And I fell in love. And that's what happens, right? And this time I did things differently. You know, I didn't get the U-Haul on the second date. I got to get to know this person. I knew his family, I knew his friends, and we had such a sweet relationship that I couldn't even tell people. It was embarrassing. We'd go to sleep at night holding hands, listening to music or reading, and we'd wake up and have coffee together. He'd get up with me even though he didn't have to get up early because he went into work later, but we'd have coffee together. He'd make me lunch and write notes on my little bags and walk me to my car. I couldn't even tell my friends that because they'd hate me, and we were having so much fun in this big, beautiful life, and then it turned out that there was a little problem with fidelity and honesty, and just really, really rocked my sobriety. And so right now he's in the process of moving out, and we've been together 7 years, and but what I want to tell you about that, which is the most amazing thing, is that I have never felt more complete than I do right now. And I feel really happy, and I feel free, and I don't feel scared, and that's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was telling Pat, I had a meeting with my sponsees. I have it once a month at my house. And they were in the kitchen talking, and I went to go do something, and I walked back into the room, and I heard them tittering in the kitchen, talking about me, how I talk about Marilyn. And if any of you know me, you know how much I love Marilyn. You're like, I know, you love Marilyn, shut up. And I heard them doing that about me, and I thought, oh, that's it. That's it right there, you know? And we are amicable, and that's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And of course, I'm devastated, and I have never experienced a betrayal at this level, but I get that it's not about me. It is not personal. Just like with my mom, it wasn't personal. It's not about me at all. And I have a solution here. He does not. I have a solution here, and if I tap into that, I can tap into that joy even in the midst of life, in the middle of being in session, in the messiness, you know? And I'm so grateful. Thank you.